Long before he became known as the Governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger tried his hand as a kindergarten teacher, or rather, he played one in the movies.
Now we're going to do something extremely fun. We're going to play a wonderful game called Who is My Daddy and What Does He Do? Yes?
Is your daddy a fireman?
He's probably big. Is he a wrestler?
Is he a basketball coach?
No.
What's the matter?
I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor.
I love that scene. Anyway, if you obsess over the kindergarten class your kid gets into, it might actually be worth all that energy. A group of Harvard economists looked at data that was gathered on 12,000 kindergarten kids from Tennessee back in the 1980s. All those kids had been randomly placed in different kindergarten classes. And the economists recently got back in touch with each of those kids, and what they found startled them. The ones who had better teachers and smaller classes were much more likely to go to college and then even earn considerably more money as adults. Now, does it sound crazy? Well, that's what the lead researcher, Raj Chetty, thought when he got the results.
We ourselves were quite surprised by the results, but they are consistent with the broader literature on the great importance of early childhood education and how that's a formative period in a child's life and can have very long-lasting impacts.
So you were looking at the quality of the education these kids were receiving and also the size of their classrooms. Obviously, you couldn't go back and analyze how good the teacher was, but you were looking at the experience of the teacher.
Correct. So there are a few characteristics that we can measure. I emphasized class size. Teacher experience is another characteristic that seems to matter. Now, our study by no means says that teacher experience is the only thing that matters. That's one thing that we can measure well in the data. And then we have a third measure that we look at, which is your peers' test scores. So the idea here is we're not able to measure all the characteristics of what makes a good teacher. So for instance, a teacher might be very compassionate or connect well with students. We don't have data on those kinds of characteristics. So kind of a summary measure, an all-encompassing measure, if you will, is how well your peers, your classmates are doing on tests. If your classmates are doing really well, it must mean that the teacher is teaching well and they're learning a lot. And one of the central findings of the study is that your own earnings when you're around 30 years old are highly correlated with how much your classmates learned and how they did on tests in kindergarten.
How much more likely was a kid who got a good kindergarten education, how much more likely is it that that kid will earn more than a kid who didn't have a good kindergarten education?
So one way we quantify it is we ask, if you were in an average quality class in terms of how the teacher is teaching versus an excellent class, so say going from the 50th percentile to the very best teacher at the 99th percentile, how would your long-term earnings be affected? And we calculate based on our estimates that for the average child, that move from an average teacher in kindergarten to an excellent teacher would lead to an increase in earnings of about $1,000 per year. You add that up over a child's lifetime and adjust for inflation and discounting, and you get something like a $16,000 gain for that child in lifetime earnings from having an excellent teacher.
But how many of these kids actually reflected that? Presumably there were kids who had rotten education or experience in kindergarten who did just fine as adults.
Oh, absolutely. So there's a lot of variation around the mean, and it's difficult for us to say, you know, this child benefited from being in a better class and this child didn't. What we're talking about here are statistical averages.
I know a lot of parents who obsess over kindergarten, right? They look for the kindergartens. They get their kids on waiting lists. Uh-huh. And, you know, I've thought that it was a little over the top. But now I'm wondering, I mean, should I be having second thoughts about that?
As I said earlier, even if though there's an effect on average earnings from being in a better kindergarten class, there's a tremendous amount of variation around that mean. So there are lots of kids who are in not-so-great kindergarten classrooms who end up doing extremely well, and vice versa. So I think the right way to think about it as a parent is it's not that kindergarten, you know, is some fatalistic thing that determines everything. But on the other hand, it makes sense to invest resources in trying to get your child into the best classroom because it seems to matter on average.
That's Harvard economist Raj Chetty. He led a study that found a connection between better kindergarten instruction and lifelong income. He joined me from Harvard University. Dr. Chetty, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chicken clucking is its own language. Or is it? Is that Yiddish they're speaking? Oy vey, whatever that means. Which introduces the new book for children, Beautiful Yetta, the Yiddish Chicken. And our next guest, Weekend Edition's ambassador to the world of children's literature, Daniel Pinkwater. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Scott. I have to make a sort of insincere disclaimer.
Yeah.
In selecting books for the program, I consider various criteria. Number one, I have to like it.
Yeah.
This book I really like. Now, it also happens by chance that I wrote it. Now, if it were merely that, I would not have brought it in because modest. But this one is so cool, mm-hmm. and the pictures are so good. I would be remiss if I didn't bring it in, so I apologize for being the author, but I say that all the time.
Well, and tell us a little bit about the illustrator, because I understand she's a very hot young talent.
Well, hot is this indeed the right word. It is Jill, the redhead to whom I have been married lo these many years.
Jill Pinkwater. I've heard
Jill
of her.
Jill Pinkwater. Yeah. I love these pictures. Don't you?
Yeah. So tell us about this beautiful young chicken, Yetta, who is Yiddish-speaking, yes?
Well, here's the thing. You know, yeah. Growing up, there was Yiddish in the background in my family, as in many families. Mm-hmm. And in our case, the parents didn't really want us to understand it because they used it as code. It was a secret language. I guess as retaliation, my brother and sister and I all took Latin so that we could have a secret language, too.
Not as many punchlines in Latin, though, or am I wrong?
One-liners fall flat. So I thought it would be fun for a kid to just have a little taste of trans doesn't mean to be a Rosetta Stone. The kid's not going to learn Yiddish from reading this book, but it's an experience of translation and comparative orthography mixed in with a story that turns out to be heartwarming and nice.
Well, let's read it. We have some guests who are going to help us out today.
Shall I begin?
Yeah, please.
Yes, I will. It is night. A truck is driving on the highway. At the wheel is Mr. Fliegelman, the organic chicken rancher. In wooden crates are chickens. The chickens are afraid. The truck rumbles through the darkness.
The truck pulls up in front of Phil's poultry world. With a tear in his eye, Mr. Fliegelman begins to unload the crates. And Mr. Fliegelman says, goodbye, my dear chickens.
Sei gesund, meine teure Hühner.
Sorry. it's a beautiful language, after all.
Yes.
One of the crates has a loose lid. One of the chickens is brave and clever. It is Yetta, beautiful Yetta. She sees her chance. She struggles out of the crate and runs down the street.
Yetta, beautiful Yetta, will not be sold. She will not be soup. She will not be roasted chicken on a Friday night. She is free. She is in Brooklyn.
I'm free.
Ich bin frei.
You turn, and then there's the skyline of Brooklyn, and Yetta exclaims,
where am I?
Wo bin ich? I don't know why this chicken looks Jewish, but she does. The streets of Brooklyn are strange to Yetta. Where is the grass? Where are the flowers? It is not like Mr. Fliegelman's chicken ranch.
There, Yetta and the other chickens led a happy life, running through the fields and eating bugs.
Oh, my beautiful home.
Oi, mein schöner Heim.
And then
she encounters some Brooklyn rats, roughly her size. Get lost.
And then a bus, she says,
oh, dear.
Gewalt! The bus nearly hits her.
Shouldn't that be Oi, Gewalt?
If there's a bus bearing down on you, Scott, I think
you
Gewalt is sufficient, yes.
Right, I gather. Okay.
And then she meets Brooklyn pigeons.
Can you help me? I'm hungry.
Kannst du mir helfen? Ich bin hungrig.
And the Brooklyn pigeons say,
go back to the farm, silly hen.
Oh, my. Yetta wanders the streets of Brooklyn, lonely, confused, unhappy.
Then Yetta sees a little green bird. She has never seen a bird like it.
What is this?
What is this?
Sneaking up behind the bird, sneakily, is a sneaky cat. The cat is getting ready to pounce.
Go away, you stinky cat!
Geh weg, du verstunkene Katz!
You know, this is not an original observation. You really don't need the English translation of Yiddish, do you?
Not well.
Fushtunkin' the cats is clearly a stinky cat. Yetta hears a voice above her head.
Look, that chicken saved Eduardo.
Mirdenayi, esa gallina salvo Eduardo.
Yetta looks up. Sitting on telephone wires are many little green birds. They are parrots. Yes, parrots. There are flocks of wild parrots in Brooklyn. This is true. Pet parrots flew away, found each other, had parrot babies, and live very well in the streets and parks.
Parrots.
Papageyan.
The parrot says,
the chicken saved me, and look, isn't she beautiful?
La gallina me salvo, y miren, no es ella hermosa? And then parrots on the line say,
come here, beautiful chicken, sit with us.
Ven aquí, gallina hermosa. Siéntate con nosotros. That's kind of a little come-hither parrot.
And then there's the sequence of Yetta trying to balance on the telephone wire with some difficulty. And then she says,
I come from the country.
Ich komme von der country.
And then she puts her arm around Eduardo, and Eduardo says,
I love this chicken.
Yo amo a esta gallina.
I love this chicken.
The parrots say,
please stay with us, beautiful chicken.
Por favor, quédate con nosotros, gallina hermosa.
Yetta stayed with the wild parrots of Brooklyn. They showed her how to find fruit and crusts of pizza.
And Yetta told them, I love this illustration, please tell Jill, of Yetta sitting down talking to a gaggle of parrots, a brace of parrots, whatever. And Yetta told them stories of her life in the country.
And chased cats away.
In time, because she was so beautiful and because she could chase cats, Yetta became the leader of the parrots. Or maybe their mother.
My dear children.
Meine teure Kinder. And they are still there. You can go and see for yourself.
I've got to go this weekend.
Is there a parrot colony yet in D.C.? There's one in Brooklyn. There's several in Brooklyn, or two or three. They've moved to Connecticut. There's a parrot colony in San Francisco, the same types of parrots.
Parrot colony in Chicago.
Is there?
And unlike the parrots in New York, the parrots in Chicago vote.
Very good.
Daniel?
Yes, Scott?
Yo amo a esta gallina, eh? I love this chicken. The book is Beautiful Yetta, the Yiddish Chicken. It's written by Daniel Pinkwater and illustrated.
And more importantly, it's illustrated by Jill Pinkwater. Yes.
Daniel, of course, is our ambassador to the world of children's literature, speaking with us from his home in the Hudson River Valley, where he's currently teaching local squirrels how to speak Amharic.
I take your word for that.
We'll mention, Yetta the Chicken was voiced by Sarah Beyer-Kelly in English. Daniel, of course, read Yetta's Yiddish. Leanne Hansen is the voice of the parrots in English and the voice of the parrots in Spanish. Esta mi. Thank you, Daniel.
Great pleasure. I had fun.
And you can see Jill Pinkwater's vibrant illustrations. And listen as our Weekend Edition team reads along on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Kindergarten is also a kind of a biolab for germs, normally nothing to be too concerned about. But in California, the state's health department is confronting the worst outbreak of pertussis. It's also known as whooping cough, the worst outbreak in 50 years. More than 2,700 cases have been reported so far this year, and 7 babies have died. Now, this is a condition that was all but eliminated by a vaccine. But more and more children aren't getting the vaccination for a variety of reasons. And doctors say that the whooping cough outbreak still hasn't reached its peak this year. Dr. Harvey Karp is a world-renowned pediatrician. Many parents will know his book, The Happiest Baby on the Block. And he explained why the disease is so dangerous for young children.
It's dangerous for little kids. It's not so dangerous for big kids. Matter of fact, for a lot of adults, you might just have a bad cold and a cough that lingers, and that's the only sign of whooping cough you have. But the younger you are, the smaller your windpipe is. And with whooping cough, you get a very thick, tenacious type of mucus. When that develops in children, they can close off their breathing tube, and they cough so hard, literally, they can't keep anything in their stomachs. They have to be on IVs because they're coughing so hard, and they can even cough so hard that they get brain hemorrhage and die. And that's the number one way that these kids die, either from brain hemorrhage or they develop a severe pneumonia.
Why is this the worst outbreak in California in 50 years? Why is it happening now?
Well, I think it is in part because of parents not having their kids immunized, and it's in part because the immunity of people who were immunized earlier has waned. That's the other big issue that's going on now, which is that by the time those kids grow up, 10, 11, 12 years of age, they, even though they got their shots as babies, they may have no immunity left. They're spreading it around. Then the parent brings it home to their young child. So back in 2005, we started an initiative to have all older children and adults vaccinated as well, so we could develop this thing called herd immunity, get enough people immunized in the community so that the chance of bringing it home to your child is going to be greatly reduced.
Hmm. I had not known, for example, about the booster shot. Why isn't that information out there? I mean, I would assume that many adults in this country don't know that they should get a vaccination for this.
Well, I think that that's the physician's responsibility, that doctors, especially pediatricians, aren't doing a good enough job. Because you go into the doctor's office for your child's care, and your pediatrician should be telling you, hey, Guy, you and your wife should be getting immunized as well. So that, I think, is the responsibility and the burden of the public health department to do a better job communicating that.
Why do you think the public relations battle when it comes to vaccinations seems to be on the losing side right now?
Well, I think that, number one, parents are very busy. They're overburdened. They're working hard, working double jobs. I mean, it's really a burden to have to be a parent and then also have to be a biochemist and have to decide, read the literature, you know, what vaccines are good, what vaccines aren't good. In the background, we have this increasing incidence of autism, which is incredibly frightening. Then you have talking heads on the media saying it may be related to vaccines. So all of that have stopped parents in their tracks from wanting to take any chance that they were going to expose their child to something that might be dangerous. I totally understand that and sympathize with that. The good news is we have a large body of information now to show zero association between vaccines and autism. But we do need to try to help parents figure all of this information out so they can make sense and make the best decisions for their kids.
That's pediatrician and child development specialist Dr. Harvey Karp. He's a fellow at the American Academy of Pediatrics and the author of The Happiest Baby on the Block. He joined us from KCRW in Santa Monica. Dr. Karp, thank you so much.
Hey, Guy, thank you very much.
Scoot up the attic, Mammy, and get down Ma's old box of dress patterns.
What you up to with Miss Ellen Portier?
You're going
to
make me a new dress.
Not with Miss Ellen Portier. Not while I got breath in my body.
Great ball of fire. I'm in my portieres now. I'm going to Atlanta for that $300, and I've got to go looking like a queen.
One of the most famous scenes in movie history, maybe American history. Scarlett O'Hara is dirt poor after the Civil War, needs to impress Rhett Butler to save Tara, her family plantation. So she rips down her curtain so that Mammy can make her a fabulous dress. But that dress and several others worn by Vivian Leigh in the movie are in bad shape. Seams are loose. The colors have faded. Now the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, Austin, is trying to restore those costumes to their cinema splendor. Steve Wilson is the film curator at the Ransom Center. He joins us from KUT in Austin. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Wilson.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what dresses are we talking about?
The dresses in our collection are the curtain dress, the portier's dress, the red velvet ball gown that Captain Butler throws at her and says, here, wear this to Melanie's birthday party.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay.
Yes, it's a good one. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning dress. And the wedding dress that she wears to marry Brett Hamilton.
Yeah.
And we call it the No More Babies dress, where she talks about not wanting to have any more babies. It's a dressing gown.
Mm-hmm.
And the dress that she's wearing when their daughter, Bonnie Blue, has her accident.
Oh, on the horse. Oh, my gosh.
All five are stunning dresses. They're just amazing. But they're just too fragile to display. Curtain dress is the one that we're really concerned about.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, remember that these dresses were only made to last as long as it took to shoot the movie.
Yeah.
The fabric is fine. It's the thread that is deteriorating. Just the weight of the velvet of this dress pulls the seams apart.
As I don't have to tell you, Mr. Wilson, there are a lot of people, when it comes to Gone with the Wind, who, if I might quote Rhett Butler, just don't give a damn.
Sure.
And so why is it important to raise what will be, I'm sure, tens of thousands of dollars to restore these costumes?
Well, there are just as many people who do give a damn about these costumes. And really, there's nothing that captures the human aspect of film like a costume does.
Steve Wilson is the curator for the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
You can see a slideshow of those dresses from Gone with the Wind on our website, npr.org. This is NPR News. Like Sergeant Allen in Chicago, Steven Slater also made news for his displeasure with working conditions. This week, he's that JetBlue flight attendant who grabbed a couple of brewskis and took an emergency exit slide straight into media stardom. But he now faces charges of criminal mischief and reckless endangerment. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, many flight attendants say that they understand Steven Slater's attitude.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the full flight. I do see a few roller boards in the upper bins, and the luggage is sticking out. You do need to get up. Make sure that luggage does close.
For veteran flight attendant Alan Boswell, this is by far the worst part of his job, boarding the plane.
Dealing with the bags, dealing with everything that goes on, with families separated, whatever is occurring, is the most frustrating part.
He says ever since the airline started charging to check bags, passengers have been trying to stuff as much as they can into the overhead bins.
And when room runs out, room runs out. We don't design the airplanes, we just work them.
Reports are it was a fight over carry-on baggage that sent the JetBlue flight attendant over the edge. Renee Foss has been a flight attendant for 25 years.
And I'm proud to say I haven't blown a chute yet.
But she says she certainly had that feeling inside, like, I just want out.
My first reaction was, wow, I can't believe somebody has finally done this.
I caught up with her by cell phone from the Minneapolis airport where she was waiting for a flight. Foss's mom was a flight attendant back when they were still called stewardesses. Foss says the job has gotten a lot less glamorous since then, as has flying. Going through security is a pain, meals aren't free, even free peanuts are hard to come by, and good luck trying to find a pillow.
Sometimes the flight attendant is just the recipient of all the terrible things that have happened throughout the trip, and that's a kind of a tough spot to be in.
And she's been in that spot many times. David Castlevetter, a spokesman for the airline industry, says full flights and grumpy passengers are nothing new.
I think what has changed are societal norms, and there is a sense of expectation and entitlement by passengers. And sadly, it has made the challenge for our flight crews more difficult.
But it is a customer service business, and dealing with passengers is just part of the job. Vita Shook is the International Vice President of the Association of Flight Attendants, and she's also a working flight attendant. So how does she cope?
You just put on a smile and say, yeah, I'll get right back to you.
But seriously, she and others say the job has gotten a lot harder since 9/11. Flight attendants have more responsibilities, and many saw their wages and benefits cut as airlines struggled to stay in business. According to the Flight Attendants Union, the average salary is $35,000 a year. For those starting out, it's more like $20,000. Alan Boswell says he works more now for less pay.
As the work rules change, that means that you have to work longer days for fewer hours and more days just to get the same hours in.
But he still loves the job because of the flexible schedule and the variety, different coworkers and passengers all the time. He says he can't wait to get back in the sky to see if maybe, just maybe, the JetBlue two beers and a slide incident will inspire the passengers to be a little kinder. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Stay seated. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. More signs this week that the sluggish economy is persisting. Friday brought news that consumer spending is flat. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 400 points for the week. On Thursday, the Labor Department reported the number of people filing for unemployment benefits for the first time went up last week. But can we tell from these trends, will the nation's economy keep lurching slowly forward, or will it slip backward and lead to a double-dip recession? We're joined now by Professor Danny Boston of Georgia Tech. In addition to teaching there, he runs the Gazelle Index that analyzes the nation's fastest-growing African-American-owned businesses. Professor Boston, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Double-dip recession, to emphasize again, is when the economy improves for a period of two and then falls back. Many banks and major companies are doing well, so why aren't they hiring?
What corporations did was to take advantage of the downturn to undertake an enormous downsize in their workforce. Mm-hmm. And that was in response to global competition. So some of the dynamics that we see in the labor market today actually are in response to events that have been taking place for the last 10 to 15 years. As a result, now what they're doing is keeping the workforce that they have, investing a lot in technology, and trying to meet the same or new levels of output with the same workforce. And so you're getting increased profitability, no new hiring.
Mm-hmm. When we say that the unemployment rate is almost 10% in this country, that leaves people with an idea that one out of every 10 people don't have a job. But I wonder, in some communities, among some groups of people in this country, is that perception of 1 in 10, if it's not a lot higher?
It is. It's significantly higher. For example, African Americans, that unemployment rate is near 16%, mm-hmm. and it's been persistently high. Among Hispanics, it's around 13%. So that rate is high, and it's almost, if we were speaking of the country as a whole with rates that minorities such as African Americans and Hispanics are currently experiencing, we would say, well, the country is in near depression state.
We mentioned you have a specialty in analyzing small businesses. What's the good news, bad news there?
When we went through the recession from 2007 and into 2008, what we saw is that 85% of all of the net new employment was being created by businesses with 50 or fewer workers. So those small businesses are very, very important. And part of the challenge that we're having now is that that sector is not healthy. It's not nourished as much as we would need it to be nourished in order to grow. And they're being hurt from several directions. One is they are normally linked to corporate supply chains. And, of course, as the corporate sector is cut back, their business is cut back. They do a lot of business with government sectors, particularly local governments, and the local governments are in fiscal crises.
Yeah.
And then just in order to make it through the recession, they had to rob Peter to pay Paul. And so their credit profile is pretty screwed up. And if they try to go in this new regulatory environment to borrow money, they don't stand a chance. And so they are really hurting. And unless we can do something to channel more business and capital to that sector, then it's going to make this process we're in much, much more difficult.
I'm very uncomfortable at asking an economist to make another prediction. You know all the jokes about economists making predictions. But all that being regarded, do you foresee a double-dip recession?
Well, the U.S. economy is certainly strong enough and fundamentally sound enough that we should not have a double-dip recession. And the only thing that I can see that would make that different is that there are some drastically adverse circumstances that would occur internationally.
Professor Danny Boston of Georgia Tech, thanks so much.
My pleasure.